The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. During his 50-year career in journalism, Fox News Sunday anchor Chris Wallace has reported on nearly every watershed national and international political event. He has earned three Emmys, the DuPont Columbia Silver Baton, and the Peabody Award, and he has interviewed no less than seven presidents. He was also the first Fox News journalist to moderate a general election presidential debate. And in 2018, he conducted a notably challenging interview with a very prickly Vladimir Putin. In his new number one best-selling book, Countdown 1945, Wallace looks at the behind-the-scenes drama as the U.S. rushed headlong toward the atomic bomb attack on Hiroshima. Chris Wallace, the screen is all yours.
Well, hi, everybody. Thank you so much for logging in. And I'm going to talk for a few minutes, introduce you to what this book was about, both the concept and also the subject. And then I guess Andy's going to come back and we're going to have a conversation for a while. But I'm very appreciative that you're taking time out in the strange times in which we live to hear about the book. So I've had the idea for some period of time that I wanted to write what I would call, well, I'll get to it. My favorite review was one of the Washington Post, which said, "I know what happened in 1945, but this reads like a thriller." And I was thrilled with that review because that's just what I wanted to write, a history thriller. And I'd had the concept for some period of time that so many history books are written, you know, we know what happened, and let's just, you know, sort of a dusty tome. Why did it happen? How did it happen? And I thought, you know, I think that misses a lot of the excitement and appeal of history, because when the actors in any great moment in history were taking part in it, they didn't know what was going to happen. They were facing enormous uncertainty, enormous decisions they had to make. And I thought if you could put the reader in those situations and take them for a ride, that would be, I think, a different and interesting way to tell a history story. So I had the concept, but I didn't have the topic until February of 2019, the day that Donald Trump was going to deliver his State of the Union address. And Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, invited about four or five of the TV anchors who were going to be covering the president's speech to her hideaway on the House side for a pre-buttle, which is a uniquely Washington phenomenon. And that is that before the speech is even given, if the speaker and the president are from opposing party, it doesn't matter if ones are, whether the president's a Republican and the speaker's a Democrat or vice versa, they give what's called a pre-buttle, which is basically to say, here's all the reasons the speech is wrong before it's even been delivered and before the speaker even knows what's in the speech. So, but this is a common practice. Anyway, we were in doing a pre-buttle in what she told us was the Board of Education. And I was very excited because I'm kind of a student of Congress. I've been in Washington for 42 years. And I knew that the Board of Education, although I'd covered the House for a year and a half, I'd never been in this room, was the room that Sam Rayburn, when he was Speaker of the House in the 40s and 50s and 60s, Mr. Sam, used as his secret hideaway by invitation only, maybe the most exclusive room in the Capitol, where he'd have cronies come over to just shoot the breeze at the end of the day or to plan strategy, and also to what they called strike one for liberty, which was to have a bourbon and branch water. Harry Truman, then the vice president, was a regular there. And Pelosi told us that on April 12, 1945, the Truman had been sitting at the other end of the table from where she had been sitting, and that he that he got a call to come back to the White House as quickly and quietly as possible, and that he had put down the phone and said, Jesus Christ and General Jackson. And I suddenly thought, I've got my story. I know now what I want to tell a history thriller about. I didn't know then what the length of time was. It turned out it was 116 days from April 12th when he gets the call to come to the White House. He's not told at that point why. And August 6th, 1945, 116 days later, when the U.S. drops the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And I thought, that's got to be a great story. And I didn't realize until I began researching it and writing it how great. And let me just tell you, the day one, April 12th. So Truman has been vice president for 82 days, just less than 3 months. And he had been completely shunted aside by Roosevelt. He had, in fact, only two private meetings with Roosevelt, even though he was now his new vice president in the 82 days that he had been vice president. And so he gets the call and he goes to the White House thinking that Roosevelt, who was down in Warm Springs, Georgia, had, without Truman's knowledge, come back to Washington and wanted to meet with him. When he gets to the White House, he's ushered up to the second floor of the family quarters where Mrs. Roosevelt, the first lady, comes out to the elevator and greets him and says, Harry, the president is dead. And he had thought he was going there to meet the president. Now he realizes he is the president. And he says to Mrs. Roosevelt, is there anything I can do for you? And she says, Harry, is there anything we can do for you? Because you're the one in trouble now. Well, the White House springs into action. As I say, the president was away, so it was a pretty sleepy place. But suddenly the word goes out. President Roosevelt has been president for 13 years. He's now in his fourth term as president, is dead. This new man who the country knows very little about, in fact, he got the nickname the accidental president, is now the new president, and that he's going to be sworn in. And so Truman calls for the members of the cabinet who are in Washington to come, the congressional leaders. They call the Chief Justice of the United States, Harlan Stone. Then they had a problem. They had to find a Bible, and there wasn't one readily available in FDR's White House. They scurry all around. They finally find a Gideon Bible in the desk of the chief White House usher. But they had another issue, which was that they had to get the new first family there. They didn't have any vice presidential residents. Bess Truman and her daughter, their daughter, Margaret, and Bess Truman's mother, Madge Wallace, all lived in a modest two-bedroom apartment up Connecticut Avenue from the White House, along with the vice president. So they had to get from there down, and there was a big crowd forming around their apartment, had to get from there down to the White House. Finally, everybody gets there, and they all form a semicircle behind the Chief Justice and the new president at one end of the cabinet room. And Harlan Stone, the Chief Justice, says, do you, Harry Ship Truman, thinking that the S in Harry S. Truman stands for Ship, which was a family name from his father's side of the family. In fact, as I'm sure a lot of you know, the S in Harry S. Truman stood for nothing. So Truman corrected him and said, I, Harry S. Truman. And they finished the oath, and suddenly Stone realizes they made a mistake. I went like this. Truman didn't go like that. He was holding the Bible on his left hand, but he had his right hand on top of the Bible. So after they had done the whole oath, they had to do it again because the Chief Justice said, you got to put your hand up to take the oath. So they finished that. Truman then addresses his cabinet, the Roosevelt cabinet, and says he wants them all to stay on and pursue the agenda that Roosevelt had laid out for this fourth term. He wants and seeks their honest opinion about every issue, but once he's made up his mind, he wants everybody to support his decision. He thinks the night is over, but it isn't, because Henry Stimson, the 77-year-old Secretary of War, says, Mr. President, I need to talk to you in private. They go into another room, and Stimson says to him, Mr. President, I need to tell you about a huge top secret project to create the most powerful weapon ever known to man. And that was literally the first time that Harry Truman, vice president, now president, had any inkling of the existence of the Manhattan Project to build an atom bomb that had been going on for 2+ years. So then Stimson says, look, I'm not going to burden you with the details because you need time to settle in. So I'll come back in a couple of weeks when you've settled in and I'll brief you on this. And Truman is, as you can expect, his mind is just spinning. He's suddenly become the president. He's the commander in chief of U.S. forces who are still fighting the Nazis in Europe and the Japanese in the Pacific. He has to deal with all of these issues. And now he has heard about the secret project that he knew nothing about. He goes home and he writes in his diary, I decided the best thing I could do is get some sleep and then come back and face the music. So that is the introduction. That is day one of the 116 days that we tell the story of in Countdown 1945. And Andy, I'm back to you.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for giving us that initial bump there with the book. I read it. It's wonderful. And I've got a bevy of questions to ask you. Almost as soon as the bombs dropped, the debate began over whether the United States should have dropped them or finished the war by more conventional means. As you've researched this topic, where do you stand on President Truman's decision to go ahead with the bombings?
Well, I'm not going to talk about the morality of dropping the bomb or not dropping the bomb, because I think the reader can make up their own mind on that. I do say in the book that I came to the conclusion that Truman really had no choice but to drop the bomb. And I'd like to talk about that a bit. It becomes clear once Truman, and he, in April, 2 weeks later, on the 13th day, April 25th, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, and General Groves, the chief military leader of the Manhattan Project, come and secretly brief the president in all the details. But at that point, it is still a science project, because despite the fact that they've been working on it, as I say, since 1942, they had never actually tested the bomb, or they called it the gadget, yet. So they thought it was a science project. They didn't know whether it was going to work. And Truman's, most of his discussions until mid-July, and I'll get there in a minute, are about an invasion of Japan. And that is plan A. That they're getting closer and closer in the Pacific. They've taken over Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and that they're going to go ahead and invade Japan. And in June, he has a meeting, Truman does, with his war cabinet, Stimson and General of the Army, George Marshall, and a lot of other people from the different branches. And they have a very detailed discussion about an invasion of Japan. And the word that he gets from especially General Marshall, George Marshall, who later became the Secretary of State, is that now we're talking in June of 45, that this war, if you invade, is going to go on till at least November of 46. So another year and a half. And the projection is that there's going to be at least 1 million Japanese casualties and 500,000 American casualties. So this is going to be a bloodbath, and it's going to extend the war for an enormous period of time. So later on in the story, just to jump ahead, in July, Truman goes to Potsdam in Germany, a suburb of Berlin, to have a summit meeting with Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and Joseph Stalin, the Premier of Russia, the two big allies of the United States in Europe. By this point in July, the Nazis have surrendered on May 8th, and most of their discussion is about the disposition of post-war Europe, and particularly the promise that Stalin had made that he was not going to keep everything that he had taken as he swept west from Russia, all of what we now know as Eastern Europe, Poland and Yugoslavia and these other countries, that he's going to create democracies there. In fact, he wasn't. He was going to break the promise he had made in Yalta to Churchill and Roosevelt. But the other reasons that July 16th, the first day that Truman woke up in Potsdam is so momentous is it was the day that they were going to finally test the gadget. It may be my favorite chapter in the book. So Truman is in Potsdam and quite insecure, I will say, about his standing as the new member of the Big Three, because Roosevelt was very close to Churchill and had a good working relationship with Stalin. Truman is the new boy on the block. He's the junior partner. But he knew that this test was going to take place. And in Alamogordo, New Mexico, 8 time zones to the west, at 5:30 in the morning, local time, they test the bomb. And there is a tremendous division of opinion among all the scientists who've been working for years on the Manhattan Project at that point as to what it was going to be, how effective it was going to be. They almost were like March Madness. They had a pool on the bomb. Some of the scientists said they thought it was going to be a dud and nothing would happen. Some of them said it was going to be a super weapon. Some said it would ignite the atmosphere and maybe take out the Western United States. In fact, the bomb is detonated at 5:30 a.m. in Alamogordo, and it turns out to be a horrendously effective weapon. There's a blast of light that is like 100 midday suns, this huge explosion that gashed a 1,000-foot crater into the New Mexico desert. Everything in the vicinity, including the 100-foot steel tower the bomb was placed on, to every blade of grass, to all the antelope, they all were vaporized. And then this huge mushroom cloud billowed 40,000 feet into the air. At about 8 or 9 o'clock that night, and again, you got to remember, it's 8 time zones ahead, the word gets back to Truman in Potsdam, it works. And he now realizes, I'm not the junior partner in this operation. Maybe I am in seniority, but in terms of clout, I'm the senior partner because I now have in my possession the most powerful weapon known to man. And at that point, the conversation becomes very different. He meets with Churchill, he meets with his war cabinet, and you know, now they have the choice, invade or drop the bomb. And when I say that I think Truman had no choice, you have to remember this was a project that was started in 1942 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. 125,000 people working on it in sites across the country. $2 billion had been spent, which was real money in the 1940s. And if Truman doesn't drop the bomb, if he goes ahead and invades Japan, and it's the bloodbath that goes on for over a year, at some point, America's going to find out that he had at his disposal this weapon that he decided not to use. And it just seems to me that was an untenable position for any politician, that nobody was going to make the decision, because of my compunctions, I'm going to relegate this country to another year of war and tens of thousands of Americans to die or be grievously wounded. And in fact, Truman writes in his diary, and it was one of the joys of researching this book, Andy, because you had access to his diary, so you could really get the inner conversation and his struggle with the bomb. He said, I think that the flower of American youth is worth a couple of Japanese cities. And that, it may be cold-hearted, but that was the calculation he made.
One of the things that I think everyone knows about, and Truman was one of the last to know about, was that it was such a secretive project. And can you talk about how they maintained secrecy and why that was?
Well, people sort of talked to me about what was the joy of writing the book and how was it to go from Trump's Washington to 1945 Washington. And it frankly, it was a relief because this didn't start with Trump, but Washington has become so divided and so polarized and so tribal. And one of the things that impressed me was that, as I say, this project started in 1942 and 125,000 people were working on it in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and in Hanford, Washington, and the flight group called the 509th Composite Group in Wendover, Utah. And for over 2 years, and not a word of this ever leaked. And the reason it seems to me that it didn't, was because of the fact that everybody was on the same side and the country was united in a way that we just aren't today. If you had 125,000 people on a secret project now to bake apple pie, I think by day two, somebody would go on Twitter and say, this is a horrible project and I'm going to blow the whistle on it. That's not the way they acted then. The other thing was, quite frankly, there were a lot of people who knew what was going on, certainly all the scientists at Los Alamos, but a lot of the people didn't know, even if they were part of it. And let me give you an example. One of the wonderful people that we discovered was a 19-year-old girl named Ruth Sisson. And she went to work in Oak Ridge, and it was a top secret military installation. And she was what was one of the Calitron girls. And the Calitrons were these huge machines with all these knobs and dials on it. And the women who operated these machines were told, just keep the meter here in the green. Don't let it go over to the red. And they would quickly adjust the knobs if it did. But they had no idea what the machine did. It turns out that the machine was enriching uranium. It was creating uranium-235 and plutonium, which was the fuel for the atom bomb. They were absolutely told not to say anything about it. All they were told was that you're working on a project that may help end the war. And the joke at the time was, my job is so secret, even I don't know what I'm doing. Which is a joke, but it in fact was the truth in Ruth's case and the case of all the other Calitron girls. And what makes her story especially interesting is not just that she provides a face in the home front, but like a lot of women on the home front, her loved one, her boyfriend, and after the war, her husband, a fellow named Lawrence Huddleston, was in Europe. And he was an army medic, and he had seen some of the worst fighting in Europe, but somehow had gotten through it, had survived. And when the war in Europe ends on May 8th, on the one hand, she's thrilled, but on the other hand, she's terrified because they knew that if they were going to invade and plans were being made, that a vast number of the hundreds of thousands of the U.S. troops who were in Europe and had just survived that war were going to be shipped over to the Pacific to invade Japan in what was likely to be an even more of a bloodbath. The other thing that was great about Ruth Sisson is she's still alive. She was 19 then. She's now in her 90s. And we found her and we talked to her. So, and that was, you know, one of the great things that is historic and in a sense, you know, in the past as this story is. In fact, we're only one generation removed. I can't tell you how many people I've met whose dads were involved in the Manhattan Project or were part of the 509th Flight composite group. So, you know, it's history, but it's not that distant history.
Yeah, and like you say, it continues to live. There were some wonderful characters that you wrote about in the book who are still with us. Sisson is one. Hideko Tomura was another who survived Hiroshima. And you interviewed her for the book. Can you tell us a little more about her story?
Yeah. One of the things that I very much felt is that, you know, we couldn't just tell the story from the American side. We wanted to tell it from the Japanese side, and especially the side, because, you know, that's part of the moral equation, is that, yes, this may end up ending the war, but a lot of innocent women and children are going to die. And Hideko Tomura was a 10-year-old girl living in Hiroshima. Her grandfather was very wealthy. He ran a major rubber company in Hiroshima. The interesting thing is, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit later, one of the reasons they hit Hiroshima was because it hadn't been bombed. And you might say, well, why that? Because they wanted the maximum military and psychological effect from this bombing. So they wanted to pick a place that hadn't been bombed so they'd be able to say to the Japanese, all of the devastation that you see came from just one bomb. And there was a lot of other cities that had been bombed. And in fact, because of that, for instance, 100,000 people had been killed in a firebombing of Tokyo. A lot of the families decided to send their kids out of the cities and out into the countryside to protect them. And little 10-year-old Hideko was sent to a school about 65 miles outside of Hiroshima. Well, her parents thought it was a school, but when Hideko got there, she found out it was basically a work camp. And they took these little kids, and if the weather wasn't terrible, they'd send them outside and they'd be go to quarries and have, I mean, the bigger kids would have to break up these big rocks. And then Hideko would had a backpack, and they would load as much as she could carry on her back, and the straps would dig into her little shoulders, and she would have to carry the rocks. She hated it. And she wanted to get out of there, and but they couldn't send letters home because the school slash work camp would censor them. So she, being a very strong, and as the story goes on, you'll see here just how strong and impressive a little girl she was, she sneaks into the nearby town and writes a letter and mails it in the post box, so that she's able to avoid the censors at the school. And what she basically says to her mother is, get me out of here. So finally, her mother arrives and is there and says, okay, I'm going to take you home. Let's just sleep tonight, but let's stay here a few days because there are air raid sirens. They're not bombings, but there are air raid sirens in Hiroshima, and it's just terrible. And Hideko goes, oh, no, we're going home tomorrow. Well, the day they go home, and she pushes her mother and makes her mother take her home, turns out to be August 5th. And of course, the bomb is dropped on August 6th. So because of her insistence, they are there when the bomb hits Hiroshima.
There were some other terrific characters that you mentioned, and I guess they become characters in the book. Journalist William Lawrence, who was along for the ride, and he couldn't send back stories to the New York Times, though he was sort of embedded with the folks at Alamogordo. And as a journalist yourself, can you talk about what that must have been like for Lawrence?
Well, this is another example of the difference between 1945 and today. It's now April, go back to April of 45, and Leslie Groves, the general, who incidentally, to give you a sense of the fact that this was the right guy to put in charge of the Manhattan Project in 41, had built the Pentagon. And, you know, which was by far the largest building in the world at that time. So he was a big man, big projects, and they put him in charge of the Manhattan Project. And he decides in April of 45, remember, they don't explode the first bomb until July of 45, just 3 weeks, 21 days before it's dropped on Hiroshima. He goes in April to the New York Times, and he goes in to see the editor, and he says, I want to detach William Lawrence, who had won the Pulitzer Prize for journalism back, I think, in 37. He was a very distinguished science reporter, so they knew who they wanted. We want to detach him. He's going to come behind the scenes in the government. I can't tell you the project he's going to be working on, and he won't be able to report anything until the project is revealed, but we want somebody to be able to tell the inside story. Well, the editor is not entirely comfortable with it. But again, it's 1945. It's World War II. He says, okay. So then they bring Lawrence in to ask him if he's game for it, because he tells Lawrence, you're going to disappear. You're going to say goodbye to your wife and your kids, and you're not going to talk to them until this assignment is over. And Lawrence says one condition, and he says, I want full access. In other words, if I'm going to be inside, I really want to be inside. So Grove says yes. And he then is inside the operation, the one real outsider, but inside the operation from then until the dropping of the bomb. He's in Los Alamos as they're working in the final months to try to perfect the bomb. He's in Alamogordo when they have the first test. And then he flies to Tinian Island, which was this little island in the middle of the Pacific, about 1,500 miles off the coast of Japan, which is a perfect launch pad to launch the bombing mission to hit Hiroshima. And he wasn't along for that mission, but he was, because the Japanese refused to surrender even after the bomb and the devastation of Hiroshima. So 3 days later, they drop a second bomb on Nagasaki, and he's in the plane for that one. So he witnesses it. And it's fascinating to read, because even though he wasn't able to publish any of it right away, he was writing a lot of these stories as they were happening. So he would have a backlog of all these things that he could put out once the bomb had been dropped and once the secret had been revealed to the world. And he's the one after the test on July 16th, who coins the phrase, the atomic age. There's one interesting postscript to the story, and that is that he comes back, all the stories come out, there is sensation. He gets another Pulitzer Prize. And in the 2000s, because now the whole relationship between the government and the press has very much changed, a group of reporters, Lawrence has passed away by this point, come to the New York Times and they say, look, this was really outrageous. He was working for the government. He was actually on the government payroll. He was writing some press releases for the government. You got to give back your Pulitzer Prize. And the New York Times said, absolutely not.
And who could blame them? So you had mentioned Tinian. Take us back to Tinian and the day before the bomb was dropped. And can you describe the scenes, the emotions at that time?
Well, the interesting thing is that Paul Tibbetts was the commander of the 509th Composite Group. And this wasn't just one plane. They had dozens of pilots and bombardiers and navigators and flight crews on ground support crews, because just on the final mission, they had seven planes that were involved. There was the Enola Gay, which incidentally was named for Tibbetts's mother, whose name was Enola Gay. And they had planes that were checking the weather, planes that were going to measure the force of the blast, planes that were going to record the explosion. The only plane that was going to go over Hiroshima, however, was the Enola Gay. And as they get to the final days, there are a lot of people who they've been told, you're going to deliver a weapon that is that could potentially end the war, but they're not told exactly what it is. And in fact, they don't tell the crew. Tibbetts knew, and a couple of other people in that 12-man crew knew, but most of them did not, or at least did not formally. And it's only when the plane has taken off and is on its way to Hiroshima that Tibbetts comes over the intercom and says, gentlemen, we are to drop the first atomic bomb. And the crew inside the Enola Gay, some of them gasp and some of them say, now it all makes sense. But there's one great story about the flight crew. And that was one of the joys of doing the research on this book, because, you know, I after the Nancy Pelosi conversation, I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't know much about it. And there was just surprise after surprise after dramatic surprise. And so many of these things were, you know, you wouldn't have written it as a Hollywood script. The fact that Truman, on the day he's sworn in, moments later, he finds out about the Manhattan Project for the first time. You know, a variety of other things. The fact that Truman is in Potsdam beginning the Big Three conference with Churchill and Stalin the day that they have the first test of the bomb on July 16th. Now, here's another story. So they always had planned to have the bomb armed and in the Enola Gay and take off. But the bomb was quite heavy. It was 10,000 pounds. It was inaptly named Little Boy. And it's in the front of the plane, and because it would have been nose heavy, they have to put an extra load of gasoline in the back of the plane. So the plane is very heavy. And in fact, it was heavier than any B-29 that had ever taken off. And so there's a real question whether when they get, and this is, I think, the longest runway in the world on Tinian Island that they had built, but whether they get to the end of the runway, whether or not the plane's going to be able to take off. And if it doesn't, and it crashes, it would be a nuclear explosion, which won't kill the Japanese. It'll take out Tinian Island and all the Americans who are based there. So about a day or two before, they say, we can't have the bomb armed when we take off. The bomb is going to have to be armed on the plane during the mission. And they go to the ordnance officer, the person in charge of the bomb, a guy named Deke Parsons, and they say, can you arm the bomb on the plane while it's airborne? And he says, well, I don't know, because nobody's ever done it, but I'll try. So they're on Tinian Island in August, in the middle of the Pacific, broiling heat. He's on the plane, on the ground, with Little Boy in the bomb bay, And he's sitting there cradled up next to it. There's really no space. It was no idea that somebody was going to have to be next to the bomb. And he is taking out some of the casing and rewiring it to get it ready. And then they have to take out the safety plugs, which are green, and put in the real plugs, which are red. Well, he does it over and over again, sweltering, grease all over him. And then he comes back and he says, I can do it. So the plane takes off. It's about 5,500 feet over the Pacific. He gets in. He arms the bomb. And they put a switch and they say, the bomb is armed. But it was only while they were on the way in the air to Hiroshima that the bomb is actually armed.
Well, I've got one more question before we go to the audience, and there are a number of audience questions here. What are the lessons for us today, and what do you want readers to come away with?
Well, I think, and maybe maybe because I've covered seven presidencies, you said, and interviewed them, and I spent 6 years covering Ronald Reagan. I was the chief White House correspondent for NBC back in the 80s. I'm really a student of presidential decision making. And there were three aspects to Truman's decision making that I thought were really impressive and interesting to me. One was, and I kind of touched on this before, how meticulous he was. He went over it over and over again. And the conversations changed as the information to discuss changed. So in this first conversation with his war cabinet in June, as I say, it was almost all about the invasion because they didn't know whether the bomb would work. And so they weren't taking it all that seriously. By the time they get to Potsdam, the bomb does work. And so now the equation becomes somewhat different. But he went over and over it again, the cost of the invasion in human lives, in the cost of the bombing in human lives. So that was one thing that impressed me, how meticulous he was. The second thing was that Truman sought dissent. He wanted everybody's best advice. He wasn't looking for, you know, everybody to agree with him. He wasn't looking, you know, for a bunch of yes men. And in fact, shortly before the bomb was dropped, and he basically by this point had made the decision to drop it, he has lunch in Potsdam with Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander and the hero of the victory in Europe. And Eisenhower has been told just a couple of days before by the Secretary of War Stimson about the existence of the bomb. And they're at lunch. And Truman doesn't ask him particularly, but Eisenhower says, Mr. President, I don't think you should drop the bomb. First of all, I think the Japanese will surrender without it. And secondly, I don't think the U.S. should be the country that introduces this horrible new technology to the world. I think it will hurt our moral standing. Well, Truman didn't take Eisenhower's advice, but he wasn't in the slightest put off by it. He welcomed contrary opinions. You know, as he said in that first cabinet meeting, I want your honest opinion. And then when I make my decision, I expect you to support it. And the third thing I would say that really impressed me about Truman was that he agonized over this decision. Like a lot of people, their sort of general knowledge of Truman, famously decisive, the buck stops here, he made a decision and he never second-guessed himself. It's not true about this one. What we found was, and again, a lot of this comes from his diaries, is that he couldn't sleep at night. He complained of terrible headaches, which he had throughout his life when he was under terrible stress. And again, in these wonderful diaries, he writes about the atom bomb in apocalyptic terms. He calls it this terrible weapon, and he calls it the fire destruction that was prophesied in the Bible. So he struggled with it. He agonized over it, and that impressed me because it may be the toughest decision that any president has ever had to make, and he treated it like that.
In reading, just going to the audience questions here, in reading his diaries, did he mention anything about his Baptist background? Someone asks if his religious background in any way impinged on his decision to drop the bomb.
No, but I think one of the things that struck me was that he put a lot of the description in biblical terms, in scriptural terms. It didn't stop him from doing it at all, but he understood the momentousness of this decision in, you know, not just in military terms, but in, as I say, kind of scriptural terms.
Here's another question from the audience. This person comments, as you know, Eisenhower ended General Grove's career in 48 because of his abrasive style. Should we be glad that we had an abrasive leader in charge of the Manhattan Project rather than the more diplomatic Eisenhower?
Well, he got the job done, so I guess the answer is yes. It was an interesting thing, though, because with a name we haven't mentioned who was enormously important to this project, and that was Robert Oppenheimer, the brilliant physicist and the scientific director of the Manhattan Project. And he was really the man in charge of getting all the scientists together and doing all the scientific work, all the research and development in Los Alamos. And the other thing that Oppenheimer had to do was kind of ride as a kind of balance or a shock absorber between this hard-driving Groves and the scientists. Groves was constantly, you know, sort of imposing or demanding military discipline and meet deadlines. And the scientists very much bucked out at this kind of military approach. You know, they were scientists and they felt differently about it, and that science and discoveries didn't come on a deadline. And they were not pleased with the pressure they were put under by Groves. And as Oppenheimer kind of, as I say, was a shock absorber to, on the one hand, deal with Groves's deadlines, and on the other hand, deal with the sensibility of these geniuses that he had working with him in Los Alamos.
Another question from the audience. Someone asks if you would comment about the decision-making process from the Japanese perspective, especially since the USSR entered the war and attacked Japanese forces in China on August 9th.
Well, it's interesting because that was quite a controversial thing. And this gives you a sense also of how conflicted Truman was about dropping the bomb. When he gets to Potsdam on July 16th, he has one objective in mind, only one. He wants Russia to get into the war. And they had said they would get in within 3 months after the Germans surrendered, that they would shift their troops from their Western Front and send them east to Asia. Now, there were a lot of people, including Churchill, who were not at all happy, and a lot of the U.S. generals not happy with the idea of Russia getting involved, because they thought Russia was going to end up doing the same thing in Asia that they had done in Eastern Europe, which was that they would take it over and extend their empire there. But Truman wanted them in, and in fact, in one of his diary notes, he says he was thrilled because the very first day, I think that it ended up being the 17th or 18th of July, he finally meets with Stalin, who didn't show up the first day, mysteriously was absent. They finally meet, and in the first conversation, Stalin says, "You know what? We're going to get into the war in August." And Truman puts in his diary, Russia is in, you know, and when Russia enters the war, the Japs, and he does call them the Japs often in his diaries, will be fini. So he was satisfied with that. You know, there's a lot of talk about surrender and whether they would have surrendered. In fact, when they get in on August 8th, it's already after the first bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima. So it's almost like they were trying to get in and sweep up some spoils in Manchuria or something, the Russians where Stalin was. But you know, there's a lot of, and I've been asked, you know, what wouldn't they just have surrendered? The fact is, talking about the Japanese military government, they dropped the first bomb on August 6th, and there's utter devastation. Tens of thousands of people killed, the city wiped out. And the military government in Tokyo refuses to surrender. And Truman waits, and he waits. And finally, on the third day, August 9th, he decides, or the military decides, they haven't gotten the message yet. So they drop the second bomb on Nagasaki, and there is equivalent devastation, tens of thousands of people killed, city destroyed. And the Japanese military government in Tokyo still refuses to surrender. And it is only when Emperor Hirohito decides to go over the heads of the Japanese government, and he arranges a radio broadcast, and he talks directly to the nation. And it's the first time that the overwhelming majority of Japanese have ever heard the voice of their emperor. He surrenders on the radio and basically takes the decision away from the military government. So I don't see any sign that the Japanese were about to surrender.
In the book, you mention a Soviet spy. Was the spy caught? If so, how? And did the spy continue to work? And what was the spy working on?
Well, his name was Klaus Fuchs. And actually, this is a very good story. And this is, again, one of those cases where you find out a story that you didn't know about, and it's like, oh man, this just makes it that much more interesting. So one of the big discussions, Churchill and Roosevelt had been partners in the Manhattan Project from the very start in 42. In fact, it was Churchill who basically said to Roosevelt, you got to get going on this. And so when Truman gets to Potsdam, he and Churchill are very much in league, and Churchill knows everything about the project. And he's told this at the same time as Truman is. Separately, they were in different villas, but he's told at the same time about the success of the project. And one of the big discussions that Churchill and Truman have is, are we going to tell Stalin? And if so, how and when? And the decision is made, we have to tell him, because if we leave Potsdam, and you know, they're supposedly all allies, although it was clear that the U.S. and Britain were much more on the same page than Russia was, that if we leave Potsdam and we haven't told him, that it's, he will see it as a great betrayal, and it'll make the bad relations among the three allies that much worse. But they decide they're going to wait until late in the conference, and then that Truman is going to tell him, and he's going to tell him as little as possible. But Stalin will not be able to say, why didn't you tell me? So at the end of one of the sessions in late July, they were having these meetings at the Sisilianov Palace, a big round table, and there was the British delegation and the U.S. delegation and the Russian delegation. At the end of a session, Truman gets up and he walks over to Stalin, and Stalin is standing with his translator, and nobody else is there from of any of the delegations. And Truman turns to Stalin and he says, Premier, I just want to let you know that we have developed a new weapon of extraordinary power, and it works. And Stalin says, well, I hope you will put it to good use against the enemy. And then Stalin turns and he walks away. And Truman is stunned. He doesn't ask any questions. What about this? How long have you been working on it? Why didn't I know? What are you going to do with it? All the obvious questions that one would ask. And Churchill, who hasn't witnessed the conversation, but he's been across the room, so he's seen the two men and how brief it is, he comes over to Truman and says, what happened? And he recounts what happened. And there's some question whether Stalin really understood the import of what Truman had said to him. Well, it turns out that Stalin was interested. He just wasn't surprised. In fact, there was a German refugee named Klaus Fuchs, who had been a member of the Communist Party in Germany. He was a Jew, and he was the reason he was a member of the Communist Party is he thought that that was the only force that might be able to resist Hitler. Well, of course, it wasn't, and he ended up emigrating first to Britain and then finally to the United States. He was a brilliant scientist. He went to work on the Manhattan Project and was welcomed into it. But it turned out his primary loyalty was still to the communists and not to the United States. And so he smuggled a lot of papers about the Manhattan Project out, and he gave it to a courier named Raymond, who was able to get it back to Moscow. So Stalin knew all about this project. And in fact, one little postscript to the story is that later that night, the night that Truman told Stalin, Stalin and Molotov, his foreign minister, are meeting together, and somebody doesn't know what's going on, but he can overhear them saying to each other, well, we better get going on this. And this story later is told, and a historian wrote about it and said that at 7:25 p.m. on this date, at the Sisilianov Palace in Potsdam, is when the nuclear arms race began. Because that was the moment at which Truman told Stalin, and Stalin and Molotov decided, we better ramp it up.
Another question from the audience. Was Truman aware of what actually happened on the ground to the people after the bomb dropped, and did he ever write about it in his diaries?
I mean, the answer is certainly he was absolutely aware, and frankly, he was thrilled. I mean, he was told... When the bomb is dropped, he is in the middle. Well, he's almost home. He's in Newfoundland. He was on the USS Augusta. He flew from Potsdam to Britain, has lunch with King George, and then gets on the USS Augusta, which is the boat he had taken over, and he takes that back. And he's in Newfoundland when they get a cable about the bomb and the devastation. And he's thrilled. I mean, remember, they're at war. And you know, he sees this as a way to end the war and save hundreds of thousands of lives. So when he gets the first message and is told about the devastation, he is absolutely thrilled. And he's in the wardroom. He bangs on a glass and he announces to everybody, you know, that we have used the most powerful weapon in history. We've devastated a city. We've killed tens of thousands. And this is a source of great celebration. In terms of his diaries and in terms of his interviews, he never expressed any second thoughts about doing this. And in fact, there's another wonderful story in the book. About a month after it was interesting. The politicians never had any second thoughts about it. The flight crew of the Enola Gay, at least publicly, who knows what was going on in their hearts, never had a second thought about it. A lot of the scientists had second thoughts, and in fact, some of them had first thoughts before it was even dropped on Hiroshima. A lot of them began really regretting their role and regretting what the technology, the weapon that they had created. So about a month after the bombing, Oppenheimer, who was really the architect of the development of the bomb, and when the bomb went off, quoted Hindu scripture to say, I am death, destroyer of worlds, has terrible thoughts, second thoughts, reservations, regrets. And he meets with Truman in the Oval Office, and he says, Mr. President, I feel that I have blood on my hands. And Truman says, you don't have blood on your hands. I have blood on my hands. Let me worry about it. And he can't get Oppenheimer out of his office quickly enough. And afterwards, he turns to his aides and he says, I never want that son of a bitch in this office ever again. So second thoughts and regrets and blood on their hands was not something that Harry Truman trafficked.
Yeah, I'd read some of the airmen were greatly disturbed by it, as well as the scientists, which you mention in the book. Ending with a real fan's note here. If there's a movie, would you consider playing Truman? And second, what's your next book going to be about?
Well, no, I would. I have to say, as I'm writing the book, and you know, it really is. I thought to myself at a certain point, it's cinematic, because I had the help of a great co-writer, Mitch Weiss, and we wove together these stories. And you know, from having read a lot of it, Andy, is that, you know, it's not just one story. So yes, we count down in the days, but April 12th, we're, you know, Dateline Washington, and you know, then 3 days later, we're in Los Alamos, and 2 days later, we're with the flight crew in Wendover, and then we're with Hideko Tomura in Hiroshima. And I could almost see in my mind's eye, you know, that little thing you'll see in spy movies where they go down and they tell you where you are now.
Yeah,
I could see this being made into a movie. And I will say that some people who've read the book and in Hollywood have talked to us about a movie or a limited series or something. And I think it's a heck of a story. So I would be thrilled. I wasn't sure. I will say writing a book is, this is going to sound like, gee, what an amazing thing that you discovered this. Writing a book is hard. There are great highs. I've told you about a lot of the highs when you discover some fantastic nugget that you didn't know existed. And you think, if I were just making this up, I couldn't have written something this rich and this revealing of people's characters. But there also are times when you just feel overwhelmed by all the information. And, you know, at certain points, you're going to have to backtrack. And how are you going to get that into the story? How are you going to tell about the development of the Manhattan Project? How are you going to tell about Harry Truman's political career and how he started out in the 20s and as a Jackson County commissioner in Western Missouri? So I wasn't sure for a long time whether or not I was going to do another book. But, you know, frankly, it's the response from the readers. People seem to have responded in just the way I dreamt that they would, that it's a page turner and people talk about being up till 3 a.m. So if you can do Countdown 1945, you can do Countdown something else. Now I just need to find Nancy Pelosi and have her tell me what the next one is.
Well, I know where you can find her. Just give me a call. I think you know too. Well, Chris, thanks so much for your time and for writing a terrific book. It moves so swiftly, like that person said, up till 3 a.m. And I want to thank all our viewers at home and encourage you to go to freelibrary.org/author events to look at our upcoming schedule. It's being updated and changing daily. Chris, thanks again. And everyone, have a good night.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.